counting down. Welcome. This is an interview for the record with Mark Zandi of Moody's Econometrics.
That's the Moody's Analytics.
Moody's Analytics. I should publish the tape over again. We will go around the room and identify.
It's going to be a podcast?
We'll bring the video in a minute.
Right.
And we'll go around the room so we can identify our voices for whoever's listening. I'm Tom Stanton of the research staff of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
I'm Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing staff for the FDIC.
Ricky DeCaser, staff.
I'm Mark Sandy, Moody's Analytics.
Rob Wojcicki of the FDIC.
Great. Welcome, everybody. Mark, why don't we start by, and we do this often, first of all, you know about the commission, you know the work we do, you've been very helpful to us in the past. Why don't we start by asking your background and career path and where you are now?
Okay. I am a PhD economist from the University of Pennsylvania. I got my bachelor's from the Wharton School. As part of my thesis work, I worked at Wharton Econometrics, which is an economic consulting firm. After I graduated, I worked there for a year or two, decided to strike out on my own, started my own company with another colleague and my brother, and sold that company 15 years later to the Moody's Corporation, where I've been an employee since that sale back in late 2005, end of November 2005. So almost 5 years
now. Okay. Right. So you're doing analytics. What was the date of your PhD?
Pardon me?
What was the date of your PhD? The year?
It was, I'm not quite sure, 1988.
So you've been doing analytics for a long time.
Yeah, right.
Specializing in the mortgage market in particular.
I would say macroeconomics. A lot of my clients are in the housing mortgage industry, so I've spent a fair amount of time examining that industry, yes. Well before the financial crisis.
Okay, yeah. Great.
And had to produce data sets and tools for trying to understand what was going on in the housing mortgage markets. Yeah.
Why don't we start with a big question, which is your perception, since we're looking at the origins of the financial crisis, your perception of the issues.
Hi, Mark Zandi.
We've been joined by Gary Cohen, General Counsel. Your perception of the big issues that you think we should look at if we're going to do a serious job here.
The big issues.
I don't know if you want to start your perception of the causes of the crisis and then play it down through the mortgage market, however you want to organize that.
Well, it's pretty clear there's many different causes. As so many, one could write a book about it, and I did. And it probably was very inadequate because there aren't many different causes to the crisis. But if I had to distill it down for sake of conversation, I think I would identify four different broad forces. One is the surfeit of global saving that developed beginning a decade ago when emerging economies, primarily China, entered onto the global scene for various reasons. China has a very high saving rate. A lot of funds were generated. Those funds were the fodder for all the money that came pouring back into our economy. And without that liquidity, we wouldn't have the raw material necessary for the lending that ultimately occurred. Sort of tangential to that, but similar, central banks were following very easy monetary policies in that period in the wake of the tech bust. Deflationary concerns were high. Federal Reserve, ECB, BOE, all were following aggressive policies. That also, I think, helped to support the liquidity. I think the surfeit of global savings was clearly more important, but tangentially important was the liquidity provided by global central banks. So that was the... there are four broad forces. That's the first. The liquidity that was sloshing around in the global financial system. Second broad force is the process of securitization was flawed. This was the process of taking those global savings and turning those into loans. Mortgage loans, credit card loans, auto loans. In that securitization process, inappropriately funneled that cash into the lending process. There were problems all along that chain of securitization, from origination to issuance to ratings to global investors and their due diligence, obviously to regulation. So the fundamentally at the core of this pipe that was created to take this global saving and figure out what to do with it was just broken, and no one really had a clear vision or sense of the entire pipe and how it was working and how poorly it was performing. Third, broad force, I would say it was a regulatory failure. At the end of the day, regulators were responsible for making sure that the securitization process was working properly, and they failed in that that function. To some degree, I think that was the result of a philosophical predisposition to think that the market was functioning properly and that the market would take care of itself. You know, these are self-interested parties, and they would figure it out. And we, the regulator, didn't need to worry about it. And so the regulatory function, I wouldn't say it was neutered, but it withered and really did not get the emphasis that was required or needed, and regulators failed. Fourth, goes to Hoover's, flat-out animal spirits. When things are going well, everyone starts forecasting with a ruler, just as now we're all forecasting with the ruler to the downside. Take the last... If house prices rise 10% 1 year and rise 10% the next, then of course they're going to rise 10% ad infinitum into the future. And if you believe that, and a lot of people did, then, or at least believe that they would never fall, then you do all kinds of things. And we did all kinds of things. So I think, flat out hubris. There's all kinds of dimensions to that, and that hubris. I mean, you could have naysayers saying, this doesn't make sense to me. But you can only say that once or twice without losing complete credibility, and then that just further cements the hubris itself. I think that was the fourth broad thing. Having said that, there are a couple, three causes that have been proffered that I would not put near the top of the list that I think are important in the context of the current policy debate. One is, I don't think Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were a significant cause of the crisis. I think they amplified the crisis, but their share of the mortgage market fell steadily throughout the boom and the bubble. If I got the numbers correct, from the Fed's flow of funds, their share of mortgage debt outstanding either through their portfolio or their insurance was peaked at 53% in 2001. By 2006, which was the peak of the bubble, prices peaked in 2006, house prices peaked in 2006, their share was down to 40%. Now, they did step in at that point, trying to regain some market share, and of course the 2000 book was the worst book of
2007,
far and away the worst book of vintage of loans. And they got a fair share of those.
And that house price appreciation could have obscured the default rate on earlier vintages, even correcting for that? It's your perception the 2007 book was...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, far and away the worst. I'd say between mid-06 through Q1-08 was absolutely the worst vintages. Yeah. And that's when they stepped in. And even though the losses on those books are high, for Fannie and Freddie, they're quite low relative to everybody else. It's just that they obviously didn't capitalize to any losses, and they amplified the mess. Let me say one other thing that is important, and maybe that's the fifth reason. I think we probably would have suffered a garden variety, or somewhat bad version of a garden variety financial crisis, if not for a series of significant policy mistakes. I think the one that everyone points to is the Lehman failure and the policy mistake that was made there. And I think that was a mistake, and that ultimately turned what was a crisis, a garden variety financial crisis, something we experience every decade or so, into outright panic and a near collapse. So I think, we probably wouldn't be sitting here today if not for that policy failure. And let me do say also, and this is a little outside the mainstream thinking, it's a little iconoclastic, but it's worth exploring. I don't know that Lehman really was the catalyst for the panic. The takeover of Fannie and Freddie may have actually been the catalyst a week earlier. Because that takeover the week before crystallized in the minds of global investors that none of their investments were safe. If they could take out Fannie and Freddie, if their equity investment in Fannie and Freddie was zero, then nothing they owned was sacrosanct and safe. And therefore, Lehman was immediately to play. And that's why a week later Lehman went down. So I think actually the panic began a week earlier with that takeover. That was botched, I think, the way that was done.
To get to this last point, yeah, those are the major points.
Yes, those are the major points, yeah.
You had said something about three items that you thought were not really causes. And you mentioned Fannie and Freddie not being a cause. I guess the second one is that the failure of Lehman really wasn't the cause of the week before with the GSEs being taken over. What was the third one?
It was really those two. Okay. Did I say three? I'm sorry. Those were the two key, I think.
The record will be corrected.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Misconception.
On number five, can we distinguish the panic from the harm that would have been caused anyway by the large credit bubble at some point needing to deflate? In terms of the damage caused?
Yeah, I think we would have, and we were, suffering a recession as a result of the what I consider to be a reasonably orderly unwinding of the bubble. That it was already having negative consequences on broader economic activity. But I think it would have been the recession we experienced probably would have gone down in the history books as an average recession. The average recession is 8-9 months long. Unemployment would peak out at 7.5%. GDP loss would be peak to trough 2 percentage points. But because of the panic, and also house price declines probably would have been roughly half of what they were, 15%. maybe 20%.
So you think house price declines have overshot because of the panic what sort of the natural economic bottom would have been?
Yeah, or more precisely, I think house prices would have gotten to where their equilibrium level in a more orderly way. It wouldn't have been struck down in the short period of time, right? You could have a period of weak house price growth and light incomes and rents catch up, or you could have just some more modest price declines for an extended period. I just don't think it would have been that crash. It was a crash, 15% is a crash, but it wouldn't have been devastating. So with the panic, then we suffered, 30% price decline, house price decline peak to trough, GDP down 4.1% peak to trough, unemployment peaking at 10, well, it's probably not even finished peaking, but, the near-term peak is 10%. The worst recession since the Great Recession. And in my view, we would have suffered a depression if not for the subsequent very aggressive policy response by the Federal Reserve and fiscal policymakers.
But to understand, if it hadn't been for the panic, if the panic could have been averted, we wouldn't have had the depth of unemployment, of house price declines, of the other amounts of pain that the economy has taken. Is that correct?
Yeah. Because the party became all self-reinforcing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it started to feed on itself, and everything just went down. So my view is we would have suffered an average recession.
Okay.
An average recession. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions. Did you want to jump in?
I want to, if I may.
Yeah.
I want to follow up on the question about self-reinforcing cycles to some new equilibrium state, which is there's one within the financial sector. Clearly, if you run, once you run one institution, asset prices can be hit, makes the other institution closer to insolvency, liquidity runs the next, and you can unwind literally an entire financial system. There's a second set of feedbacks between the financial sector and the real sector. Can you elaborate on which of those you sort of are thinking about in terms of the sort of spiral, like, I assume it's September, October 2008, general mind?
Yeah, all of the above. First, you're absolutely right. Because of the close linkages within the financial system, when somebody gets in trouble and starts dumping assets on the marketplace, it takes down prices and takes out liquidity and creates problems for everybody else. There's self-reinforcing cycle in the real economy. That is, house prices decline, people put in negative equity positions, they default, house prices decline. That's another self-reinforcing cycle. Now, and then you have the third one that you alluded to, the credit restrictions, the economy goes south, it creates more losses for the banking system and the financial system more broadly. They have to pull back in another self-reinforcing do loop. So there were a number of different self-reinforcing, and there's others too related to, I think, just general psychology. Things start going bad, start taking the ruler and projecting the other direction, and it's self-fulfilling. It actually affects real asset prices and real economic activity.
Do you have a sense of relative magnitude or importance of, let's say, a pure credit crunch type effect on the real economy in late 2008 into 2009 versus, let's say, a demand side where consumers just pulled back out of fear or cash hoarding or something else? As opposed to direct exposure of financial system that wouldn't lend, right?
I think the serious collapse in economic activity in Q4-08, Q1-09 was a pullback in consumption, real economic activity, that households and businesses saw the collapse in housing and stock prices and, the obvious just complete turmoil and significantly pulled back on their spending and investment. You can see it in the rise in the personal saving rate during that period, particularly among high-income households, that really just battened down the hatches, and they account for a big chunk of spending. You can see it in terms of business investment. I'm sure there were some credit effects. I can't issue CP. My bank's not lending to me. But even there, I suspect, at least initially, it was more I don't know what the heck's going on here. I'm literally stopped because the whole world stopped. I mean, the real economy seemed to literally stop in October. And then I think we're now still feeling that the credit crunch has taken longer to play out. And we're still feeling the ill effects of that. I mean, that's still playing a role in consumer spending and business investment, probably most importantly in terms of hiring decisions by smaller businesses. That's my intuition. That's my intuition.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go back to the panic for a minute. There was a panic in August of 2007. Was panic avoidable?
I would say that was a panic. In August of 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was a garden variety financial crisis. I mean, that was it felt like to me, circa 1998 Asian crisis.
Okay.
You know, that kind of a crisis. And in the 1998 Asian crisis, that could have turned into a panic. But policymakers acted aggressively and successfully. In fact, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac played a very important role in putting an end to that crisis quickly. They provided liquidity. In fact, as I recall, the financial system froze up for a couple, 3 days. It felt pretty ugly. And they stepped in and started buying securities, most of the mortgage securities. That's when their balance sheet really started to expand out. And to some degree, they jump-started the financial system and kept this house.
So you don't think that it wasn't in the air that as over-leveraged institutions, or however you want to call them, got into trouble, that at some point the market was going to panic?
No, it was nerve-wracking, and stock prices were falling, and credit spreads were gapping out. But it felt, it was a financial crisis, but it wasn't a panic that we're going to remember for the rest of our lifetimes, right? It wasn't that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can remember the day before things started to fall apart, and, you know, everything was ripe for a financial crisis. It wasn't necessarily a case that it would be a complete outright panic.
Got it. If I can go back for a minute to your primary causes, your four big ones. Securitization. My memory was that another time we had a global influx of money was the petrodollars in the 1970s. And there the money flowed out into sovereign lending, which went bad.
Mm-hmm.
Why did it go into securitization this time, and why in particular to housing?
Well, going back to the surfeit of global saving, let's just pick on China because they're the best case in point. That's where the money, most of the money is. But, you know, it applies to many other emerging economies as well. But our current account, our deficit, our trade balance with China was ballooning out, and that's where a lot of the dollars were coming from. Emerging economies came into money for the first time, really, in early 2000s. I mean, they had nothing before that. And I think like anybody, any young person who gets money, well, the first thing they do is they go buy on my day, they would buy a stereo. But what do they buy now? There you go. They buy an iPhone or an iPad. And then they would presumably sock away some cash, right? At least that's what my dad told me I needed to do. You should have cash cushion in case something goes wrong. And I think the Chinese first bought treasury securities. You know, this is money good. And that's my CD. Well, by, you know, the mid part of the decade, they had enough treasuries. And they were starting to search for yield. So what's the next best thing? One step removed from a treasury but gives you an extra bit of yield. Well, that first is Fannie Freddie debt, and then it's, you know, Fannie Freddie MBS, and then it's this other stuff.
The other stuff, it was naturally then, because they'd been used to MBS, they went to private label securities. How does that,
they went into mortgage securities. They went into Ginnie's and Fannie Freddie securities. But that drove down yields further, and so the rest of the market is now searching for yield, right? Everybody else out there saying, you know, I need yield.
Mm-hmm.
The spreads are coming in. Junk spreads are at 250 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
I need yield. I'm getting paid by my clients to give double-digit return, at least double-digit return. So they start moving out the credit spectrum. So the emerging investors, you know, sort of brought down the whole yield structure, brought in the credit spread, and then you know, all these other hedge funds, other risk-taking investors decide I need more yield, and so they start pushing out and going looking for yield in private labels of mortgage security.
So I'm trying to get the intersection between that search for yield then and the fact that it was securitization rather than debt or anything else.
Well, it was simple. It was a liquid market, seemed like a liquid market. It had ratings. It was very straightforward to do. You didn't have to do a lot of, and this is part of the reason securitization broke down, is that you thought you didn't have to do a lot of your own due diligence or work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a simple, easy kind of investment, gives you an extra yield, and
it's a AAA.
Yeah. And everyone believes in it, right? And there's good stories that house prices never decline, and, you know, they might decline in California, but they don't decline everywhere across the country. You know, those kinds of stories.
Just to finish up on your points, you mentioned regulatory failure. Simon Johnson has written fairly provocatively about the reason for that and argues that it was the power of the institutions that either were regulated, wanted to be regulated lightly, or weren't regulated and didn't want any more of it. Thank you very much. Your sense of the sources of the regulatory failure?
Well, I mentioned the philosophical predisposition. I don't think the Federal Reserve was co-opted by big banks. I don't believe that. I think they felt that the market was functioning well, and these were, some, again, as I said earlier, self-interested parties, and they were big boys and girls, and they knew what they were. They presumably knew what they were doing. And they didn't need that kind of regulation. They didn't need that kind of oversight. So I don't think that the regulatory process was co-opted in that sense. I think it was just a predisposition to believe that the marketplace was working well and would work fine going forward.
And is the, I mean, there have been arguments in the academic literature that house price appreciation was part of that predisposition. Do you see that, or is it something different?
Well, I think there was a, in terms of the regulatory decision not to, I think to some degree, to be fair, we had not seen national house price declines except in the Great Depression. No one thought we were going to go back to the Great Depression. That we had seen regional house price declines in California and Florida and New York and Massachusetts, but never a correlated nationwide kind of price decline. And if you read some of the speeches that Chairman Greenspan was giving back in that period, you know, he alluded to that. And so I do think that was in their thinking. It gave them some comfort.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was a driving force, though, in their thinking. But I think it gave them some comfort that, you know, this isn't like a stock market. You know, housing markets are local, and if one goes down, doesn't mean they're all going down. Yeah.
Let me ask you had mentioned about ratings and comfort from that. In 2003, there was a failure of rated AAA rated mobile home securities.
Mm-hmm.
And among the institutions holding this stuff, one of the lessons was you better not rely blindly on a rating. Any sense of whether that was a pervasive thought around 2003, and if so, what happened to that? As we, I mean, 2004-5 isn't that far
right
out from that.
Right. Well, as you know, I'm employed by a rating agency.
Right.
So no matter what I say, I lose. Because you won't believe me, even if I...
It's amazing the number of people we believe who work for somebody.
Okay. All right.
So this is my sense of there's many issues, but one of the key issues is this, and this goes to this one flavor of the hubris problem. You're sitting in 2005. Let's say we're sitting in 2004, and we rate bonds, and they come up with their ratings, and now we're in 2005, and we go back and look at how the ratings did in 2004. Well, the ratings look to be overly restrictive, right? The credit performance is better than the ratings would have suggested. So you're sitting in 2005, and you're learning this, and users are saying, you got it wrong last year. What's going on? So in 2005, you say, okay, I'm going to. I've got my tools. I've got my models. This is what I believe, and these are my ratings. Okay, in 2006, not a single loan in San Diego is delinquent in 2005. Your ratings are wrong, badly wrong. They're overly pessimistic, right? So now the issuers come to you and the investors come to you and say, but you're wrong. You don't know what's going on. In fact, you don't understand how this market works. So the pressure intensifies. So you begin to think, maybe I haven't got this quite right. And so you go back and you take a look at your models. And just one quick preface, I'll stand back. I'm not part of the rating agency, so I don't know this firsthand. This is just my sense of it. You could be sitting in 2006-07 and you're saying, maybe I was wrong for 2-3 years on the wrong side of this. I don't want my errors to be serially correlated. Maybe I should be a little easier with respect to my ratings. And so, of course, that's the wrong decision at the wrong time. But that's part of the hubris. That's part of getting caught up in the environment that you're in. And everyone does. I mean, even all the regulators get caught up in it. All the investors get caught up in it. I don't think anyone is immune from that kind of pressure because you've been wrong for 3 years on one side of the arrangement.
Your answer takes the perspective of a rating agency for understandable reasons.
Or I told you you were really
important. I didn't believe it. We're taking it all in. Or from the perspective of an issuer. My question really was about the investor. Given the experience with manufactured housing, asset-backed securities, and whether that wasn't a sign to investors that they should do their own work in addition to looking at a security.
I think they too got caught up in this. I don't think very many of them remembered the manufactured housing debacle, to tell you the truth. That was a more very isolated kind of esoteric event that people attributed to some degree to fraud and other issues. I mean, Conseco and all kinds of stuff. So you could come up with reasons why that blew up. So other than the securitization process failed us, right? I think the CEO went to jail, if I recall. So I don't know that people drew a lot of lessons from. I did. I remember that very clearly, and made me wonder about what was going on. But I don't think many in the industry did. Here's the other thing. If you go back into that period, there was a lot of money, remember? A lot of money coming in that needed to be deployed very rapidly. So they being a global investor, that's the term I'm using to describe this group broadly, they were overwhelmed. The pipeline was overwhelmed. They didn't have the time or the inclination. They really didn't have the resources or time or the energy to really do that kind of due diligence on their own. They just, they got the capital. They needed to deploy the capital very quickly. Spreads were coming in very rapidly. They felt like, they too got caught up in the frenzy of the time.
By spreads coming in rapidly, do you mean that somehow I can make more money doing a deal today than next week?
Yeah, if I don't buy now, I'm going to lose I just take junk spreads. 500 is your average spread over 10-year treasury. 450, 400, 375. You see this and you go, my God, you know, if I'm not going into this market, I'm gonna get locked out. Mm-hmm. So I got to get in. And it was very self-reinforcing, of course.
We've talked to some investors who bought private label securities, and clearly CDO investors are in the same boat, who now are really unhappy. One investor told us that a huge percentage of the private label stuff they bought, they thought was fraudulent, and 100% violated their reps and warranties.
Right.
So they were going after anybody left standing.
Right.
How much information, understanding the dynamic you've just pictured, but if somebody was a heavy participant in that market as an investor, how much information did they have about the underlying mortgages and the extent to which the mortgages, in fact, conform to reps and warranties? And I mean both for the PLS side and for the CDO side.
Yeah, I think they could have gotten the information if they wanted the information. They could have requested to get a randomized sample of the mortgages in pools, but I think again they were overwhelmed and they didn't have the time or energy. Excuse me, turn this off. To do that, but you make this is a good point. I do think that fleshing out this the point of the broader point about securitization being flawed. One of the most significant reasons for the flaws in securitization was that there was no mechanism for ensuring that the underlying mortgages were what they really said they were, right? I mean, these were stated income loans. They were based on appraisals, based on comps. Nothing in the file was real. But no one had a responsibility for making sure that that was correct, that was true. There was no one in the pipeline and had to do that. Now, ultimately, you would say the global investor should have demanded that, but they failed to do so because they, first of all, they may not have completely understood that no one in the pipeline was responsible for that, for doing that. And partly because they were overwhelmed and caught up into the frenzy of the time.
There wasn't any incentive for anybody down the chain to say no, because nobody gets paid for saying no.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, now, it's that's where the regulator comes in. Yeah, that's the regulator's responsibility, right? I mean, at least checking or requiring someone in the pipeline to make sure, but no one did that. And you take the rating agency. I mean, they're very upfront about it, right? They say, we don't re-underwrite loans.
Right.
Right? Like GE, I get their financials and I rate their bond. I don't go into GE's accounting department and make sure that I'm getting correct information. That same principle was applied to RMBS and ABS, right? I'm telling you, the issuer and the investor, I'm not re-underwriting these loans.
I don't want to push you in this area because of your personal situation, but I would mention I was at a company once that was rated. And despite those representations, in fact, and this was in the 80s, the rating agencies went in and did at least some preliminary due diligence to be sure that representations were reasonably accurate.
But I don't think they're required to do that.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So I think that is, I'm not sure, but I think that is now changed, all for the better. I mean, I think there needs to be third-party vetting of any underlying data to make sure that, you know, the loans are what they really say the loans are. But I think, you know, when we're originating in 2007, as I recall, half the loans are stated income. I mean,
but that would have been known to an investor, right?
Yeah, fact. That's everyone knew that. Yeah, everyone knew that. Yeah.
And nobody had a concept of what, I mean, in the olden days, two decades earlier,
yeah,
No borrower could walk in and be given the option of saying, well, this is how much I made, give me a loan.
Well, actually, two decades ago, that did happen, right? And we had a series of, you know, if you go back to the SNL.
Oh, okay. Yeah. SNL, sure.
Yeah, sure. A number of those engaged in statements.
So that was,
and
that
was a lesson. You would have thought that would be a lesson, right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Role of technology. You highlight securitization. I wonder if there is an underlying set of technology developments that are influencing the way the crisis built up and then unfolded.
Well, I mean, I do think in terms of the techniques used to evaluate the risk in the securitized loans, that you know, they were built on poor data and faulty assumptions and bad modeling. And I know this firsthand. I mean, I can give you an example. House prices. I don't think very many of the investment banks who were issuing these securities understood how to measure house prices and what really they were measuring. I'll give you kind of an example from my own experience here. We were forecasting three house price series back in 2004 and 2005. It was called the OFAM series,
right?
And that's the FHFA series. Mm-hmm. The Case-Shiller series and the Median Realtor series. And, you know, these series, time immemorial, pretty much track each other. If they didn't, there was very clear explanations as to why mix issues, you know, made the median go off relative to the OFAO and so on. But they basically track. So you were getting into 2005, late 2005, early 2006, and these series are starting to diverge. You know, the performance is diverging, and I'm getting confused. So I really now investigate very carefully how these things are, what they're measuring, and how they're constructed. So I rebuild the models, and this is now early 2006, maybe even late 2005, and I produce different forecasts because the OFAM series is wildly different than the Case-Shiller series and the Realtor series. And I produce a paper, and I tell all my clients that, you know, this is why we're making this change. Most of the clients moved. And I made my advice to them was that if you're doing these things, most of them should move over to the Case-Shiller series. The OFAO series was irrelevant.
Is that because of the loan limits on the GSEs or what?
Yeah, they weren't in subprime. They weren't all day. They were, you know, prime conforming loans. You know, they weren't the problem loans. The default rates were a lot lower. And by the way, getting back to crisis versus panic, I'm not sure. You know, those conforming loans would have gotten into the mess they got into if we didn't go from crisis to panic, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Most of them did the right thing. A few of them did not do the right thing, and they stuck with the OFAO series. And just so happens, those are the institutions who are no longer with us, right? So, you know, I don't know. Either that was a conscious decision or a misunderstanding or just laziness, or I can't really explain the logic behind the decisioning that was done, but you know, they made the wrong decision. They didn't reserve properly, and they got creamed. You know, when things start going south.
On the downside,
yeah,
because if they understated the downside,
yeah,
is what you
significantly understated the downside, right?
But there are notable. So there are notable biases, for example, some of the Case-Shiller, the repeated price methodology.
Yes.
In particular, the selection effects are bad late in the cycle.
Yes.
Right, so the houses are flipping, or the ones that are subject to rapidly rising comps and the like.
That was the initial
percent overstate on the way up, and then overstate on the way down.
Yes.
Right, okay, it was a more damp series.
But that wasn't really an issue in 06, 07. I mean, it was, you know, that's...
03, 06, yeah, maybe true.
Yeah. But the point is that OFAO hadn't even turned, right? It didn't even turn until 07 or 08, really, something like that. Case-Shiller was peaked in Q1, 06, right, Q2.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I would conceivably, one way to think about this is, with hindsight, if you advise your clients in 2003 not to believe Case-Shiller as much as OFAO on the way up.
Right.
And never made that bet, and then you're probably fine sticking with OFAO through the downturn, because you haven't
Yeah, that may be true.
I don't know why he's doing Case-Shiller forecasting number three, but
yeah.
But that's a good point.
But they were only 10 city series back then.
Yeah,
that's good. Finally, became 20 later in the total.
Yeah,
you could have been saved by Sherlock. You know.
But I guess my point is that I think there was a general, going back to technology, general just complete lack of understanding of the most basic data series and trying to evaluate mortgage risk. Bear Stearns wouldn't even pay for the case. I have a joint venture with Case Shiller. I have to charge a certain amount of money because of this relationship I have with Case Shiller. It's expensive data because it's expensive for various reasons. It's okay, it was cheap. It's free. Here's Bear Stearns saying I don't buy Case Shiller data, which is, to me, was mind-boggling. Right. So
the cost.
Yeah.
So they used FHFA or OFAO as their
So in that case it was the cost, and obviously a misunderstanding too, right? Because if they understood what was truly going on, it was the cost is nothing. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Looking back.
Yeah, looking back.
Right. So you notice these indices diverging.
Yes,
and you looked, and what did it tell you?
Well, it was clear that they were measuring different parts of the market, and the parts of the market that many of these institutions were in was not the OFAO, it was not the conforming market, mm-hmm. It was the non-conforming market, and the Case-Shiller would be a better series for them to use to judge credit risk than OFAO. I said you should make this change, and here's why. We made the change. Here's the modeling changes we've made, and I advise you to move over. Unless a couple of institutions argued, well, their book was more like the conforming book, and they didn't change. I'm not sure that's true or not. I don't know.
Let's talk for a minute about the relative risk. Or have you finished technology? Or
yeah, no, I'm done.
So there are several streams of mortgage originations back through the secondary market. We have the agencies. We have securitization. What is the relative riskiness in your perception of the loans that were originated and held, say, by small local banks or thrifts? That's sort of a third stream that's a smaller stream, but it's there, and I'm just curious what that looks like.
Well, to be frank, that's never really gotten on my radar screen. I think that those books are
that small.
It's that small. I mean, it's not material, I think, in the grand scheme of things.
Okay.
I mean, for small banks, it's a commercial real estate portfolio. It's not their residential mortgage portfolio. Some did auto loans. That may have been somewhat of a problem, but I don't think it was their residential mortgage book that created a problem for most of the economy.
Is there any empirical data that shows that the small banks that retained actually mortgages, that actually held them on their books, did better than securitization stuff?
I think that would come out of the FDIC call report data. I think we could get that from the FDIC. Yeah, because you'd have institution by institution, you could see the credit performance.
It should be, is it?
No, it's not.
Your supposition is right. That's where you have to go to look. It depends on what years and which call. The issue is that for the big banks, at least, you don't get to see the breakdown in first lien, second lien, and other types, second property kind of thing. So it's a weird mix. I mean, you can see a residential real estate line.
Yeah.
It's a very weird mix of what's on there. It might be true on the direct call. You might be able to see at least first lien mortgages, but.
Yeah.
At least on the bank call reports, it's such a mix, you can't really tell what's there. Because, of course, the standard stuff is on sold to the agencies, and more of the subprime all day, it was all went out to the other pipeline. So it's a hodgepodge that was left behind, and it's not well delineated.
But, of course, I think they cherry-picked, too, right? I mean, that was also part of the problem of securitization, right? They would cherry-pick.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. If you keep anything, you keep the rest. Yeah.
And if you're a small bank, you know your customer pretty well, right?
That's what my assumption was. But if you're saying it's such a small percent, we don't even need to worry about it.
That's the residual in the grand scheme of things, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, total debt, total mortgage debt outstanding on bank balance sheets is, you know, $500 billion, $600 billion,
yeah, which is nothing.
Yeah, right.
That's good. Let's go back to Fannie and Freddie. There's an argument, and somebody's used the word corner solution to talk about it, that Fannie and Freddie had the conforming market and took, you have said, basically a reasonable quality compared to what went into securitization. And the argument is that with Fannie and Freddie taking that market, and I've heard it from small banks, for example, that really left them with commercial loans and other things, commercial real estate, that were quite a bit more risky than the mortgages they formerly might have dealt in. And one can make the argument that both Fannie and Freddie taking higher quality stuff left the securitization market with more risky stuff. Any sense of those dynamics and what that means, and whether Fannie or Freddie had a distorting effect on the mortgage market?
Well, I keep going back to the share of debt that they had, you know, 53 in 01, 40 in 06, in that five-year period, which was the boom and the bubble. I mean, that's a huge share shift in a very short period of time. So I don't think they played a key role in that dynamic. I don't think that dynamic really was a significant factor in that period. I do think, though, by end of 06 and into 07, Fannie and Freddie were now getting upset about the loss of market share. And it may have felt that it was politically threatening because it was becoming difficult to meet their housing affordability requirements. So I do think they stepped in very, very aggressively in 06 and throughout all of 07 into early 08 when the book was particularly bad. And they took on their balance sheet a significant share, particularly the all-day securitizations. And, you know, obviously that was a lethal mistake. And they probably, if they were as capitalized as a, you know, if they were a well-capitalized institution, I think they'd still be with us, right? Mm-hmm. But they weren't. You know, they were capitalized to a conforming loan with very low default rates. And so, you know, they went down fast.
Let's talk about that. I mean, if housing prices, depending on your index, peaked in early mid 06, it wasn't just Fannie and Freddie that seemed to take on greater risk appetite right around that time, maybe starting at the end of 05.
Right.
I mean, it's in a public record, WAMU. You can go to others. Lehman is on the public record.
Right.
You can keep going.
Right.
What are the dynamics of that, given the number of people that we can interview who would say, well, we just thought housing prices were going to go up? Well, when housing prices stopped going up, what's going on there?
Yeah, I think that we had a huge mortgage infrastructure in place to produce mortgages. I mean, we had 03 refinancing boom. 04, 05 were huge volume years. So we had a lot of people employed in producing a mortgage in these institutions. And so when you got into 06 and 07, things started weakening. Then, ironically, that's when they really started pushing on the pedal to try to keep the pipeline full. I mean, you're a senior manager at a major financial institution. You've got an empire. You've got, you know, people. And to some degree, you probably feel, you know, I'm employing these people. I don't want to lay these people off. I don't want to, you know, reduce I don't want to reduce the size of my organization. So I think the decision was to actually, in a sense, double down and become even more aggressive to try to keep that pipeline going in full.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want at least to get your statement yes, no. Also, there were ample loanable funds still.
Oh, yeah, plenty of cash, right? You're absolutely right. There's still plenty of cash sloshing around. Our current account deficit was at its maximum point in 2005, 2006. That money has to go somewhere, right? And so it was just, you know, flowing in, rapidly flowing in.
If we can go back, Soros talked about the mortgage bubble as sort of the, what set off the larger bubble, but he considers we had a much larger credit bubble. Is that your perception? And I'm interested in your thoughts about where else besides home mortgages, we've talked about commercial real estate, that money flowed.
Yeah, I think it was a broader, the bubble was broader than just housing and residential mortgage debt. It began there first. It was that's the largest part of the bubble because there's just so many more dollars involved. I mean, the residential mortgage market's $11 trillion. Commercial mortgage debt is, you know, $4 trillion. It's a huge market, many more dollars involved. But it did start the euphoria, the hubris, the risk-taking did extend out beyond mortgages into commercial mortgages, into other parts of the asset-backed securities market. It got it into the CLO market and broader commercial lending market. But I think that party got going a lot later because that was the root of the recession in the wake of the tech bust. It was over-levered businesses that was the fodder for the recession in the wake of the tech bust. And so, you know, that memory didn't fade and regulatory oversight was greater and it just took longer for that, for people to overcome their fears again and start lending aggressively. So it really only got going in the 2006-2007 period. It hadn't developed nearly as fully.
And leveraged loans,
yeah.
Right, the same thing.
Yes, sir.
You've gone through a huge number of my questions to other people.
I don't know if you mentioned this earlier. I know you've been paying enormously close attention to what we've been doing. Do you have any suggestions as to the extent that you think we haven't covered anything in our investigations, in our the public hearings and things that we've had? Is there any big gaps that you see that, without having prepared for this question? Do you see anything that we should be looking at or any questions that are enormously unanswered?
No, I mean, I think you've been pretty comprehensive. I can't think of any gaps. I mean, if you kind of think of the way I laid it out, you seem to have touched upon each aspect of this pretty well.
If you were writing another book on the subject, what would you cover that you didn't cover before?
Thank you, Freddie.
Yeah,
I would spend a lot more time on that. Because, you know, that's key to the policy making and how we structure housing finance going forward. I didn't cover it because I didn't think it was that important. Although, now that I've learned more, it certainly deserves a chapter. And I'm going to do edition 3.
Just this morning on NPR, which is where I get my news these days, they had another Fannie and Freddie session. So.
Yeah.
Apparently there's a conference today.
And we're there, right?
Yeah.
We're there.
I spoke with that, yeah.
Anything brilliant coming out of there yet?
No. Yeah. I think there is a consensus developing that Fannie and Freddie will be significantly diminished and will be replaced by an explicit government guarantee that will provide catastrophic insurance. That for securitization. So, you know, I think I was surprised by the amount of consensus that, at least ostensibly, that was among a pretty diverse set of people.
A little bit out of your area, because it's not directly housing related, but it's more of incentive related. Have you been paying attention to all the compensation proposals, you know, what they're doing in England Buffett has come out and said, and the rest about clawbacks and things of that nature. Do you have a view on any of that?
I don't. I haven't thought about it carefully. I find it a very difficult thing to get my mind around. I don't know how. I recognize it as an issue. And I remember going to a conference, what's the fellow's name from University of Toronto? Very good econometrician. Chicago Banking Conference, and this was back in like 2006, 2007, and he was railing against compensation, and I
kind of completely dismissed it and was completely wrong. John Hurd, but I haven't thought about it carefully enough to give you any information that you don't already have.
Can I ask a couple questions? I want to ask you just a couple simple questions. You were talking about that you're number five, Lehman, and the psychological impact of that. Can you elaborate on what you meant by policy mistakes, if we are looking back in a report and thinking about looking forward and the impact of something like that? What are the takeaways from that that are important looking forward?
Well, I think beginning with Fannie and Freddie, then Lehman, and then the series of failures that followed over the course of the next 3-4 weeks, I think the policy mistake was that each of the failures was treated as a transaction, that I just need to get this deal done. And there was no sort of overarching comprehensive perspective on how we should approach this. What would be the fallout from doing all of these different things? And so I think it created a great deal of angst and uncertainty in the investor community, that all the creditors of these institutions thought their investments were up in the air and they wanted out immediately. They just all ran for the door. And so that was what created the panic. It was the lack of any coherent strategy with respect to each of these problems. Now, in all fairness, this was all happening very rapidly, and I'm sure people were just completely exhausted and out of their minds. So I'm not saying anyone could do any better, but I do think that that was a very significant problem.
Was there a way to have communicated about it that would have been more reassuring? No.
I think that if we got to Lehman, that they should not have put it into bankruptcy. Now, the argument is I didn't have the authority. Mm-hmm. I just don't buy that. I don't. There is a way around everything if the system is going to fall apart. I think there was just a lack of understanding of what the fallout of that would be. And
you're saying you think there was a lack of conceptualization of that.
Yeah. And also some nuts and bolts, what is it going to... Where are Lehman securities? Mm-hmm. And what happens if they're worth nothing? That's a simple question that needs an answer, right? Mm-hmm. And if we had that answer and they found out it was the reserve fund, then they may decide, we're going to figure out a way to keep this guy going for another week until we figure that out, right? So I think that was just... a huge mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, a huge mistake.
Let me ask you also about, you talked about where we are in unemployment, and you said it might not have peaked. So we're thinking about a report that comes out in December, and it's going to be read by all kinds of people in all walks of life. So should we be talking in this report as if we're in the crisis? It should not have a past tense feel to it? How would you say that the tone should be about crisis?
I don't think we're through.
Okay.
I mean, I think we're past the panic, but the fallout is still, very palpable, right? I mean, I think we're still in it. We have a 9.5% unemployment rate. You're still in the soup. And there really is no, if we go back in the soup, there is no policy response, right? I mean, the funds rate's at zero. The budget deficit is $1.4 trillion. Nobody wants any additional stimulus. So, I think it's in the present. I wouldn't put it in the past. And come December, it's going to feel like in the present. I don't think it's going to feel like in the past.
The other thing, a simple general question, is you've talked about historically, every 10 years, there's some form of garden variety, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Is that what the public should expect? Is that the way we should convey it?
Yeah, because that goes...
You should just expect that.
I think we can mitigate the severity of those crises, and I think we have with better institutions and better management. I mean, if you go back 100 years ago, I think they were more debilitating and severe. I mean, to some degree, they're less frequent than they were. I think if you go back in the previous century, it was probably every 5 years. We cut that down to about every 10 years. But I don't think that, it goes to the human psyche. And it takes about 10 years for senior management to roll over.
And the next guys that come in think they're smarter, brighter, better models. My son definitely thinks he's smarter than I am. So when he takes the rein, he's going to think I was a complete idiot. And you know what? We blew it badly. You know, our generation blew it. Again, it's just a travesty what we did.
The last question I had on my list was about clients. It's a natural thing to ask you who your clients were in past and current that,
sure.
that are have their feet in this.
Right. I have lots of clients. Fannie, Freddie, all the major mortgage insurers, mortgage companies, banks, Treasury, OCC, the biggest clients are regulators, big financial concerns, industrial concerns, you know, GE, Siemens, Boeing. It's pretty broad-based. My client base is very diverse, so I don't have one or two, three big clients. They're each, you know, relatively small. But it is wide-ranging. I mean, I'm sure if you name the institution, they're probably a client in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I express my views. You know, I'm not afraid to. And you know, I mean, I think the mortgage interest deduction should be reduced, and I will say it, and they're my clients. Because I think it's in their best interest, and they don't even know it. I argued for cram down in bankruptcy. I think that was something we should have done. And it would have made this much easier. And, of course, a lot of my clients didn't like it. So, you know, I know this, I'm tooting my own horn, but just so you know, I take great pride in that. One thing you should also know, I don't take money for policy analysis. So if anyone came to me and said, can you do an analysis of the economic impact of the mortgage interest deduction, for example, or the Bush tax cuts or anything like that, I will not take, I deciduously don't take money because there's just no way not to even, you know, I don't want to even have the appearance that I'm being affected by money.
I have one last question. In the midst of all of this debacle, what firms got it right and why?
You know what? I don't think anyone got it just right. I think we all got caught up in this to some degree or another. Even there are a few who got it right and are pretty rich, but even there, in a completely randomized world, someone is going to do, you know, it's going to succeed like that, right? So I'm not sure it's anything but a random event. I think what made this crisis so unique is that it engulfed everybody and everything. Yeah. I don't think anyone did it right. Exactly right.
Thank you. This has been very informative.
Oh, good.